You emigrated to California to work for a satellite manufacturer, and then you met Elon Musk right. at a rocket launch in the Mojave Desert. Mm-hmm. What was your first impression of Elon Musk?
It's been a while, so I gotta really trying to remember that. So he looked a little bit like out of his place, a little bit, I think is probably the right term. And this is like the desert, he ran around in shorts. Nobody does that. On the other side, he asked the right questions right away, right? I mean, it was clear that he understood the problem and he knew what needed to be done. So that impressed me on the other side. And then I knew that he had money from PayPal.
Hmm.
Well, maybe I didn't know this at the time, yeah. But it was just like, for me, it was just like interesting to talk to him, and that was it pretty much. And then he just called me back several weeks later. So I guess the first impression was like somewhat interesting, a little bit nerdy, and not really like the other rocket people that are like in the desert, different from them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in 2002, you became the fourth technical employee of SpaceX.
Right. Yeah.
And what actually persuaded you to join? And was it a big risk at the time? Because it was quite a new startup.
No, it was not a risk at all. Fundamentally, he had like, I think he was ready to invest $100 million. That's not a secret. And he had that money, actually. So I figured, you know, if you have $100 million, if you want to spend $100 million, you probably have to work on that for like, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years. And I wasn't totally wrong with that. It took us, at the end of the day, 6 years to spend $100 million. And then we were pretty much out of cash in 2008. But so I figured, you know, for a couple of years, this is no risk. Yeah. I mean, the biggest risk is that he gets bored and wants to do something different, or that we hit like technical problems and he's giving up too early. That's absolutely not the thing that Elon does. He doesn't give up, and he doesn't give up over technical problems either. So at the end of the day, that side wasn't risk initially. I mean, there's always a risk at the end of the day, right? If you change your job. But I thought actually it was pretty safe for the first couple of years. And then after that, then you have like, I don't know, like 500 people or 1,000 people. Now you actually have to get the money in, right? It's much more risky now. It was funny because other people just did the reverse. They thought in the beginning, oh, this is risky. I don't want to do that. And then in 2007 or 2008, when we finally went to orbit, they thought, oh, this is not risk anymore. And that's actually, the reality was just the other way around.
And so was it the other way around because it was now a large company and you had to make sure these people got paid?
Exactly. This is like the aircraft carrier that you're trying to shovel the coal into the engine, and you're burning money, you're burning cash for such a big company. Of a bigger company, rather, and you need to, at the same time, you need to establish yourself on the market, which is not that easy. So, I think the risk in that sense is just reversed. In the beginning, I think there was very little risk for working there, and then after a couple of years, there was definitely more risk because you now needed to feed, I don't know, 500,000 people.
And was that the best way to do that, was to try and get contracts from places like NASA to help them out? Was that
correct.
The best way? Yeah.
Correct. I mean, the ultimate customer is NASA, right?
Yeah.
And NASA actually came through with a contract called Commercial Orbit Transportation Service, I think, COTS. Mm. Yeah. And that contract was worth $250 million. And that happened by the time we successfully launched Falcon 1, not Falcon 9, right? And the deal was basically, I mean, in simple terms, I don't know the details, obviously, but they wanted to build like a Dragon capsule, and that was built, financed by NASA. And then SpaceX considered the Falcon 9 portion as their contribution. Yeah. Mm. So it was not 100% money for the program, but it was split rather, and there was some investment from the SpaceX side required.
Mm. Yeah. And if we go back a bit, what was your childhood like, and what actually inspired you to become an aerospace engineer to begin with?
Oh, I know. I grew up in the a little bit north of Frankfurt in Germany, like kind of like rolling hills thing. My father was a veterinarian working in the lab. My mother, they had a similar medical direction, but nothing really remarkable, I would say. I was pretty good in physics and math. And then I was fascinated by airplanes, but I also knew that I was wearing glasses at the time, so and there was no LASIK. I guess LASIK hasn't been invented then.
Yeah.
And so I knew that it would be difficult to be a commercial pilot for Lufthansa or anything like that. So the next best thing was becoming an engineer in aerospace, and that's kind of what I did. I did work initially in airplanes, and then I, just coincidence, I had a friend, and he convinced me, hey, check out, you know, we're building a satellite here at this place. And that was at the university. And so I checked it out, and I was actually fascinated by that. You could build a satellite at the university, and I became pretty good. So basically what happened is I switched completely over from airplanes over to satellites. I learned everything you needed to do with satellites, and it took me a little bit longer to finish. On the same side, I would also know more about satellites because I knew some stuff about airplanes in addition to that.
Hmm.
So yeah, that's how I ended up on satellites. And then from Berlin on, so this was now TU Berlin, the Technical University of Berlin. And then I got a job in Bremen, actually, which is another medium-sized town in northern Germany, and they had a satellite project. It was very similar to what I worked on at Berlin. And so I just started seamlessly basically on that satellite project. And it was pretty successful.
Mm.
So that's how I ended up in the satellite world. We got an offer from like a small company here in Los Angeles, to be for like 2 years on the working visa, the H-1B. That's exactly the visa that's being canceled, or not canceled, commercialized, I would say is the right term right now. And at that time, if we would have to pay $100,000 per year or even one time, I would not have been able to do that at the time. So I would basically have continued working in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time it was just a visa. You had to, I don't think there was any fee with it. You had to do certain conditions basically. Yeah. Mm. I got the visa. I came to Los Angeles, started working at the company, and it turned out it drew me a little bit into sounding rocket territory. They had a sounding rocket program, and I worked on that.
Mm. What's a sounding rocket?
Basically not an orbital rocket. Actually, not sure where the name comes from. Probably a sounder kind of payload thing. So it was supposed to go up 100,000 feet or something like that, and then come back again. It was more like a technology experiment the experiment itself was the engine in combination with a tank. The idea was to not build a turbo pump, but pressurize the engine to the tanks. I was skeptical all along about this idea. What did I know at the time? And so I started working on that program I did mostly avionics, so electronics and kinds of control. It flew. There was like a small one that flew that didn't fly actually, that burned down on the test stand. I think it flew later, and didn't get very far. It was unguided, so just aerodynamically stable. And then the second one was controlled, and there was the guidance control system was not done well. It kind of tumbled for a while, and then it stabilized. So I learned a lot on that, let's say it this way.
Yeah. And when you first joined SpaceX, am I right in saying part of your role was hiring new people?
Yeah, I mean, that's... Elon basically tried to hire principals, and basically he basically made MVPs in of their particular area, and there was Tom Mueller with propulsion, obviously, still famous for that. Chris Thompson worked on structures, and then I worked on pretty much everything else. Not everything else, actually. So my job were basically avionics, all the electronics on the vehicle, guidance and control, and flight safety. And then after me came Tim Buzzer. He was responsible for launch, so for the ground stuff, everything. And then after Tim came Gwynn Shotwell, and she was responsible for the business side of it. Mm. And that was pretty much the five principals that... hired people into SpaceX and basically build up the departments.
Mm, yeah. And was it easy or hard to convince people to join SpaceX in the early days?
I don't think so. I think it was harder to convince people that had experience. And this goes back to, this is a risky thing, right? And then also we didn't want people to come over because we had whatever we paid them more money or so. So we wanted people that came over because they actually thought this is a great idea to do. Yeah. Mm. And so you find those people, there's probably less people if you constrain it like that. But at the same time, you get people that are really good.
Yeah.
And that's what we had actually. We had really, really good people from the get-go. So the team was really great. They also, we hired pretty young people. We hired, in many cases, we hired people straight from school. Mm. So they had the experience from school. And then my job or the principal's job basically was to teach them. This is how we want to do it, right? And that's how we basically built a company that's different and still people do the same thing, right? Mm. I mean, they do it in a certain SpaceX way.
Mm, yeah. So it's almost like developing a certain ethos or philosophy for that company. And that's easier to do when someone's young and hasn't got a lot of experience, right?
Exactly. If you have experience, then you pretty much try to attack every problem with your experience. You say, okay, last time I did this, this worked, so I'm going to try it again. That is there's some benefit on having that a little bit of experience, but there's certainly a downside if you try to squeeze every problem into your experience. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what most people that are a little bit older and are more senior, I guess, in companies, that's how they work, and that's part of why it is so hard to put innovation through in certain areas. Yeah. Mm. I mean, our particular innovation was reusability.
Yeah.
We wanted to be reusable. And so, in many cases, people just wouldn't believe us that this would work.
Mm.
And to be fair, we were skeptical a little bit on our side too, right? We flew a parachute, but it was clear that just flying a parachute is not enough to get the vehicle back. And you have to do more. And it took us a while to actually get the vehicle flying and then trace, go back to that problem of re-entering on the first stage and making harden it up basically saw that it survives the reentry. But all the time they flew parachutes, they were always on there.
Yeah. And how long did it take for the rockets to become reusable where they'd fly back down in the chopstick arms? How many years did that take for you guys to develop?
Oh, the chopsticks. I mean, the chopsticks was very late. The chopsticks is basically Starship only, right?
Yeah.
For Falcon 9, we had legs. And so the downside on having legs is you fly them up and down. So they're basically wasted payload, or you pay a penalty, and they're pretty heavy because they're pretty big. And so just the first landing was, actually it's coming up almost 10 years ago, 2015 on, I do remember that day, it was either, I think it was December 21. And it was pretty epic. But so we landed the first one on land, and then we learned how to land it on the drone ships, or the barges basically. The first one we reused commercially was, I think I want to say 2017. And it was an SES mission. SES is a European satellite operator, and they've been with us early on, and they've been one of the first commercial payloads that we flew. And then likewise, they were the first to use a previously flown booster. That's the terminology. It sounds better than used.
Yeah.
Like a car. Yeah. Previously yeah. owned. I think it was September 2017, but I'm not totally sure. I guess everybody can look that up if it's really important. So it took us another 2 years or 1.5 years after the first recovery to figure out on how to actually recover them so that they don't see damage, or that they see minimum damage, and then to fly them again. And then the cradles, the cradle basically is the spinning this one idea further. Like, I don't want to carry the leg because they don't contribute to going to orbit. So I'm going to catch the rocket with a different device. And the cradle is basically the idea to catch it in mid-flight. And then you have it actually already there where you want to reuse it. Yeah, it's already in the launch mount. And so you have to check it, make sure everything's good, and then fly it again. That's the ideal process, right? In reality, on a development, like on Starship, you have to check that actually everything is okay. Then the other downside is obviously if you miss the cradle, you kind of like impact the launch site. That's frowned upon. It's definitely a bold move to use cradles on the launch mount and to catch the returning stage with that.
Yeah. And how much criticism or doubt did you get from the rest of the industry when you were developing these reusable methods?
So
wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
When you're working within SpaceX, you're pretty busy and you don't really care too much about the rest of the world. And so your head is down and you don't really see this. In retrospect, I found like videos on conferences where people uttered words like, oh, this will never work. And those videos didn't age well.
Yeah.
It's probably, fair to say. So my gut feeling is... Also, there's really no, for somebody building a rocket, yeah, the business is to build rockets. So using that rocket multiple times is actually not great for your business to some extent. So instead of producing, let's say some companies would launch like a dozen times. So they would order a dozen first stages and a dozen second stages, obviously. And if you do that, then if you were to reuse it, you could just order one thrustage, yeah, and fly 12 times.
Yeah.
So obviously that is not great for business. So there's very little incentive for a rocket vendor or like somebody who builds a stage to say, oh, I just want to make it reusable and then have it built only once instead of 12 times. Because obviously that goes near in your revenue and your bottom line. So your business might die over that. The only benefit is when you actually operate the rocket and now you don't pay for those 12 first stages or boosters. You only pay for one. And that clearly is a huge benefit for your bottom line.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think what I'm saying is there was really no incentive for other people to mimic or to copy us. You know,
yeah.
Very little. And now this and nobody really looked that far ahead that if SpaceX is successful, then they're in trouble. Because then SpaceX can be a lot cheaper and they're still stuck with the old business model where they have to buy a stage every time they want to launch something. So now is the time where you look at this and go, well, it's time to catch up, right? But pretty much everybody was relying or hoping that this doesn't work out. I mean, everybody else.
Yeah. And how is reusable rockets going to change the space industry? How has it changed the space industry and how's it going to in the future? What does it allow you to do?
So the one interesting aspect is actually when you have a reusable rocket, you kind of know the rocket, you kind of flown it and you actually tested it the way it should be tested, right? So now you do the second flight and as long as you make sure that everything is has margin and can still work for another, it's 3 minutes actually for a booster, yeah? Plus the landing. So the whole booster mission is like 10 minutes, something like that. Incidentally, it's almost the same as the whole rocket mission, which is also about 10 minutes there. So when you see this in the webcast, the landing is like a couple of seconds before the shutdown on the second stage. It's pretty close. So once you make sure that everything is good and that you're actually, I think, have a booster that is more reliable than a new booster. Yeah. So there's a change in thinking now. It's almost the opposite of what it was before. Before people and the customer basically said, oh, we want a new rocket just to make sure it's new, yeah, and fly. And now they actually say, well, we think we want to have the second flight, yeah, or the third flight. There's a time when you fly, let's say you fly 20 times, where fatigue and other issues may be on the rise. And then they say, well, we don't want the rocket that's 20 times flown. We want the rocket that's like 3, 4, maybe 5 times, something like that. Yeah. So, and on either side of the life cycle on the booster, people would say, we don't like these ideas. These ideally, we want the one in the middle of the life cycle. Yeah. But anyways, that's already a big change in thinking from the customer side. So that's one change. I think actually the rocket got more reliable by doing so. And that's Falcon 9 has been very reliable. The only problem is there was like a little bit of problem on the restart. And it was not a mission. It was mostly the stage related issue last year. Came with the second stage, and the second stage is not reusable on Falcon 9. So there you go, right? But the booster itself has been super reliable over many, many years. When you knock on wood, right? That is one aspect. Obviously, the other aspect is instead of building 20 rockets, you only build one. You've got to catch it and inspect it and carry it back, which is all expensive. You got to then, you know, refurbish some parts when you see stuff. Yeah. But at the end of the day, this is nowhere near the price of a new rocket. So it became a lot cheaper for SpaceX. The reason launch prices haven't really come down is primarily because the market is just pretty high and the next rocket is so much more expensive. So SpaceX can be like a dollar under the next rocket, and that's the price. Yeah. prices came down really a lot for the transporter missions. Those were the ride share missions, and that had to do with primarily with the competition. There is a smaller rocket, so it costs less, and the ride shares are incredibly low cost compared to other rockets. Yeah, so that worked really, really well for ride shares. It it lowered the cost dramatically, right? I forgot exactly what the prices are, but you can look it up on the SpaceX website. It's really, you can launch satellites for an amount of money that's like 100,000, what used to be millions.
Wow.
Yeah, it's, you can look it up, but so it's really good to have that. And there's so many ride shares that I think, like, the industry of small satellites vendors and many other, I mean, vendors and then part vendors for satellites has been grown, and it's pretty amazing to see that.
Mm.
It's all kinds of new satellite companies around here. It's not just around Los Angeles, but obviously here too, like Apex or K2, and there's all kinds of, or like if you look at others like Astroforge, obviously too, Fast. I work on a few of those as an advisor, but I'm really fascinated by how many, you know, how the whole landscape is of satellite builders these days. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. And what's the most exciting satellite project that you've been aware of that's about to start or has started in the last few years?
All right. I mean, if you discount Starlink.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Starlink is pretty amazing as a satellite project. And in fact, my video here, or it's my video, my internet here is Starlink.
Nice.
So I hope the transmission is good.
It is good. Yeah. Yeah.
but I just started as a beta tester for Starlink, and then I kept it, and it's working great. I never changed it here in my house in Los Angeles. Although Starlink is actually built for like rural area, and not for cities, because in cities you have usually good internet. Like because I was testing it, I just kept it and gives me an idea on how well it actually works. Mm. So Starlink's definitely exciting. I personally work on another project that's called Astroforge. It's asteroid mining, and it sounds crazy. You know, certainly is to some extent. but it's exciting because they actually do have they do actually mine. They try to do mining on asteroids. Yeah. Building satellites and not just building PowerPoints and trying to build a big project. It's actually a small project, yeah. So so I think that's pretty exciting too. Let's see. Other projects. I mean, the other thing that I work on a little bit is VAST. That's exciting too. They build a space station. It's a private space station, so it's human spaceflight. It's pretty incredible to just think this through, that a private company would build a space station. The only one that we know, I mean, there's the Chinese station, but then there's also the International Space Station that's been built by agencies, and not just one agency, not just NASA, but also JAXA and the Europeans, ESA, basically. And so here, in contrast to that, like here you have a company that actually tries to build the same thing. And that's pretty incredible.
Mm.
So that's VAST. There's other applications that also happened, like microgravity production. It's mostly medication, I mean, pharmaceuticals at an experimental stage at this point in time. And the company that does that here is Valor. But these are all companies that to some extent came out of SpaceX. They have either SpaceX people or former SpaceX people working there, or they are launching with SpaceX. So they're all somewhat related, and they're basically children of SpaceX to some extent.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me a bit more about the microgravity thing. How is that related to healthcare?
I think there are certain cells that grow better under microgravity. I'm not even sure that that's what they do. But they want to they're building some pharmaceuticals. They grow them basically under microgravity. And in microgravity, you don't have your crystals can be really large. There are certain things you have no convection. So there are certain things that don't exist, and you can basically your mechanisms of crystal growth and other stuff is different. Yeah. So I'm not totally sure what that does in details. Yeah. Mm. But you can grow stuff that you can grow on the ground. It could grow a different quality. And there's some medication that takes advantage of that. I have to be somewhat generic because I don't really know the details.
Yeah. And for that asteroid mining one, how will that work?
Well, the idea is to fly to an asteroid. Yeah. Attach yourself to an asteroid, and then start using laser and other tools to get the metals out that you really want, and then fly back. So the final version requires a pretty big satellite because you need propellant and everything to come back. But this phase right now is primarily trying to find out how to actually launch and land on an asteroid. And then maybe do some mining just to figure out on how good this actually works. It's an early phase of the whole thing, obviously, but it's at least technology development, and that's pretty it's pretty amazing to see that. And the prices on some of these are potentially high enough so that it's worth it. I was always joking, like if the asteroids would be made of gold, I mean, definitely this would be a thing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Right. They're not. There are other metals, but there are some metals that are equally, expensive and platinum, whatever, and attractive to industry. Yeah, I mean, there's probably better people that can describe that. There's actually a podcast out on Astroforge's website, so they discuss this a little bit more in detail. Mm. For me, the idea to have interplanetary spacecraft done on a small company and launch them is the one that fascinates me way more than the actual application.
Yeah. So do you think that's going to be the future of space, these small startups creating their own niches in the space?
Correct.
Industry,
basically the startups go, they basically rethink the whole thing. Like industry... based on experience, right? They have this old satellite, and they just basically warm it up and build it very similar, because that is what worked. And then here are small companies that want to do it differently, and they try new ways. They try different architectures, they try different components, and in the end, they might actually. Well, in the end, the goal is to make it cheaper. So the fundamental problem on space, in my opinion, is not that space is hard. I mean, space is hard. But the fundamental problem was always that we made it really expensive.
Yeah.
And so the industry became an industry that, needs big government contracts and can't fail because now everything is so expensive. It's kind of like a vicious circle.
Yeah.
You build something for $5 billion, you're not allowed to fail it, right? And then because it is so expensive, you got to make sure it actually works. And so that has cost and cost on cost, yeah? So that's how it happens that like a telescope like James Webb, which is, amazing.
Yeah.
But suddenly costs as much as the light years it can look into, namely 12 billion. So... It's like a dollar per light year. So, anyways, no, it's not. It's a billion dollars. So, either way, so I botched the joke. But these are very expensive, and they're very expensive also because you can't take a risk. Yeah, and it makes them more expensive. So, but here, small companies they can take a risk, and they might find ways of making things better and cheaper. And that's kind of the idea behind it.
Yeah, it will lead to more innovation because there's less risk involved. So they can try maybe more, you know, risky stuff.
I think it is 12 billion years, right? Or 13 billion years, something like that is the age of the universe. So it is a dollar. Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be pretty cool if we could see that far.
A dollar per year, basically.
Yeah. In 2005, SpaceX is unable to launch in Vandenberg, California. So you have to launch in the middle of the Pacific on an island called Quaj. Could you tell me more about that experience and what you learned from it?
So the island is called actually Kwajalein. It's spelled in a weird way. You cannot guess the name from when you... It's K-W-A-J and so on. And it's part of the Marshall Islands. And there's an army base there that's used for... At the time, it was used for missile defense. And so they're used to launching rockets from there, actually. And so we contacted them because we were just curious. We had some work that was related to them. And then we just thought, well, why don't we launch from there? Yeah. Maybe that's a little bit easier. And it turned out to be, yes, it is easier. Partly because when you launch in the middle of the ocean, your safety requirements are relaxed. I mean, there's not a lot you can hit. So you got to make sure that certain other islands, you can't hit those. But that still gives you a lot of room. And so it's safer to launch from there, fundamentally. The other thing is nobody really watches you. You're on your own. There's a downside is obviously you have to get there. And there's no radio, or no DigiKey on the island. Yeah. Amazon does not deliver. Maybe they do by now, but at the time they didn't deliver there.
Yeah.
And everything you need, you have to basically ship down there. Minus the coconuts. But it's really hard to, the logistics are difficult. And that's in the end was the problem why we gave up on it too. Logistics for a bigger rocket, human space flight is way, way more difficult. And Cape Canaveral is the right choice there. But for like the early tests, I thought this was actually pretty good. We had enough room, couldn't hit anybody. And B, we were pretty much on our own and nobody would like watch us very closely. If I imagine that, all the attention that Starship gets now would have been on SpaceX in the early years, this would have been way more difficult.
Mm.
So we basically went down there and we launched three times and then we came back and basically we were successful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what we learned on the island, we learned basically without anybody watching, and that's good. Yeah. It was mostly like embarrassing. we launched three rockets and failed three times in a row. And then the fourth one finally worked. It took us a little over 3 years to get to the point.
Mm. Yeah. And what was the day-to-day like in the Pacific when you were working on it? I've heard many stories of using like these wooden planks to move rockets and this tiny airstrip. So what was it like living?
No. I mean, it was primitive, I would say, yes. So we had a small island. So Kwajalein actually is not an island, it's an atoll. It has it's pretty big. It's like, I want to say it's 120 by 80 kilometers or something like that. Yeah. It's really huge in that sense, yeah. And there's the inner lagoon basically, and the islands are like a ring around it basically, yeah. And we had one of the islands that was I want to say like 20 miles from Kwajalein itself. And so a few people would stay on that island overnight, but we didn't have enough sleeping accommodations. So the majority of people would stay on Kwajalein and would take the boat at 6 o'clock in the morning, jump on the boat and go up to Omelek and then work the day and then go back with the boat that comes back again. So ironically, my commute was about as long as it is in Los Angeles. only it was on the boat.
Yes.
And that boats are fun when you do this on the weekend, but if you do this every single day, boats are not fun.
Yeah.
It's actually harsh on your back end. But I mean, it was exciting certainly for a time. Everything is tropical. Everything's very warm, very humid. We started out in a hangar without air condition. We finally got air condition. And so, it took a while to, set everything up and make sure that we had enough food and everything, so we could actually work efficiently. But, on the other side, it was also exciting to be there. It's an area that I didn't know about this. The islands are basically, I mean, the whole atoll is basically a reef made of coral, right? And sticks out of the water in some places and accumulates land. But everything is coral.
Wow.
And so going down there, you see the coral growing and you see it going, getting to the surface. And when you see this from the up, then you wonder, what is that? Yeah. And then when you're there, you realize, oh, this is just a huge coral, just a mountain of coral, basically.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like amazing. I haven't seen that. I mean, I grew up in Germany, right? So clearly there's very little coral.
Yeah.
And so this was new to me. And I thought it was pretty fascinating. I wouldn't miss it. I didn't spend, I spent probably half a year in total over the 4 years there. So I was traveling a lot back and forth. Other people stayed there for much longer than me. But I thought it was always fascinating.
Mm, yeah. Very, very cool experience.
Yeah, and definitely.
What made SpaceX succeed and not become one of the many failed startups in the space industry? What were some of the fundamental things?
Yeah. Those are difficult questions at the end of the day, right? I mean, because I think certainly, Elon is a big part of that. The team is another big part of it. Yeah.
Mm.
So the team would basically not give up. The team would be really, really good technically. The team would be really good communicating. We would not work in silos. We would, work very, very, very transparent to other people. We had great communication among us, between us. We basically had no doors in the company. There was just cubicles. We used mobile phones like at the time when it just came up, and we would basically do email from the phone early on. Mm. And so there would be constant communication that definitely, helped us. Other things that we just had the best people, I think, in their particular areas. And we also spent a lot of time on stuff. I mean, there was a lot of work that went into it. So there was a lot of persistence and persistent work. But let's see what else. I think fundamentally, there's also a couple of things that, like on the company level, supported us really well. For example, we would always make decisions. Yeah. And beginning with Elon, basically, if you had a question, you'd say, should we do this or that? He would say, do this. And we knew that some of the decisions were based on incomplete information. But so in other words, if new information becomes available, we would change our mind and walk back. That happened, but it didn't happen very often. We would basically do like trying to estimate a little bit like this is more likely to succeed, so let's just go this route. Yeah. It's not perfect, but we never wanted to delay a decision. Time, we always favored time over money.
Mm.
And that also means you have to make a lot of decisions in an environment where you don't really have all the information, and then you watch that. And if the decision was clearly wrong, then you walk it back and change it, yeah? And people at SpaceX knew that this can happen. Yeah. It's actually a requirement that you work there, that you're flexible on that aspect. So that definitely was a great thing. The second thing was Elon gave us all the tools that we needed. Everything was pretty much discussed in terms of costs that went on the rocket. Like if you want to buy a certain component that goes on the rocket, you wanted to have this component as cheap as possible. But if you need a tool to design something, then those discussions were really shorter. I mean, it was more like, oh, this is a tool. Okay, let's buy it. If it makes your life easier, if it makes your life quicker, or your development cycle quicker, of course, then there would not be a lot of discussion. We would buy it or we would lease it. We would, whatever we could do to afford it, basically. Yeah. So those were two different discussions, whether things would go on the rocket or things basically would help us working. And that Elon pretty much gave us all the tools that we needed for that. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's pretty much a lot of companies don't have that. I mean, good communication, time over money, quick decisions, basically, all of it. And then really, 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 really good people. That still hasn't changed, actually. I still believe that SpaceX has the best engineers you can possibly get. Attracts the best engineers by now, obviously, and picks the best one too. Hiring, the way we hired was elaborate and difficult to find the best person. But I think we did that.
Mm, yeah, definitely. And why is speed so important?
Well, time is money right now, right? At the end of the day, and everything, every discussion, every decision you delay because you don't have information, you don't want to decide today, we decide next week. You know this from, I mean, even in your personal life, right? You delay this because you're not totally sure. And then suddenly it's like 4 weeks later and you realize, you haven't done that, right? Timely decision is really, really important for efficiency. Efficiency is important for your money, for your bottom line. And that's just why SpaceX became a really fast moving company because of their principles, basically.
Mm, yeah. And you led the reliability team at SpaceX, which involved
I did in the end. I didn't do always. At the beginning, I did avionics. Like I said, avionics, guidance and control, flight safety. Then for a while, I focused on flight safety. For a while, I focused on guidance and control. I was never a double E. I mean, so I didn't really know what I was doing on avionics, right? And we found somebody who was just way better than me on that. And so I was happy to actually get rid of avionics. I'm a person that can duct tape things together pretty much. And I'm pretty good on the guidance and control analysis. I understand that pretty well. But so as time goes on, your company finds specialists, yeah?
Yeah.
And so it shapes the company architecture a little bit more. And so I ended up basically in a position where I was between everybody and looking at, on the system level, at reliability. And I did this primarily, how did this happen? I think I worked as a launch chief engineer for a while. It was purely coincident for me. But I worked anomalies then. I started working with the anomalies on Falcon 1, the stuff that didn't work, basically. Mm. And it forced me to think into other systems. But I had, at the same time, I had a pretty good system knowledge and I could explain how things work. And so I ended up doing the anomaly investigation, one of the first one on Falcon 9. We lost an engine on flight 3, I think, 3 or 4, I forgot which one. I basically led the investigation. So that means at the end of the day, I didn't even do like the hard work to figure that out. I basically just put it all together into something that puts it into context. Yeah.
Mm.
And here's what happened. And then this is what we have to do for the company to be better. Yeah. I don't know. I think that just worked pretty well. So I kept on doing that. Falcon 9 had two major anomalies along the way, and I led both of them. And so I basically we convinced Elon, this is actually good. I mean, we can prevent anomalies if you do certain things. We need a little team. We started building up a team that was primarily focused on launch chief engineer work and fixing anomalies. And the team is still there, actually. And the job is basically to prevent anomalies. And if there are any, to resolve them and make sure that they never, ever happen again.
And what's the hardest anomaly that you had to resolve?
There are basically two. One of them was the AMOS-6 vehicle there wasn't even a launch. It was a static fire. Exploded on the static fire. It was pretty dramatic. And this was an anomaly that happened in like less than 100 milliseconds. It basically followed. I mean, there was just like, it went from nothing to boom.
Wow.
And it was pretty wild. And it was a really difficult investigation what caused that. We figured it out in the end, but it was very, very subtle. Subtle. It has to do with COPVs. Those are pressure vessel there. It's composite overwrapped pressure vessel. Yeah, COPV. It's like a metallic liner, and then you wrap carbon over it to make it stronger. And then because they are in liquid oxygen, and they see big temperature cycles, that's what fundamentally led to the anomaly. We made some changes, and then suddenly it didn't work anymore. We reversed the changes, and it worked again. So those are pretty energetic. And then, like I said, it was very difficult to actually figure that out. But we did in the end.
And how long did it take for you to figure that one out?
This one, almost 5 months, I think, maybe six.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the company doesn't completely come to a halt, but yeah, it pretty much comes to a halt anyways. We had another one before that. Actually, I think the CPV one wasn't that long. I think it was 4 months. But the one before that was almost half a year. There was a case where we lost a tank inside a tank. And because the tank inside the tank was buoyant, it jumped up and hit the tank dome on the top and broke it. And then once we found out what happened there, we fixed the component that the strut basically that held it down, and then we launched. That was the famous launch in December 21, 2015. That also landed. So not only did we recover from an anomaly, the first flight after that, it's called return to flight usually. We also introduced the landing part on that. So that was a really, really big mission. That was pretty amazing. But yeah, these things take long. And then in those 6 months or 4 months or whatever it is, I don't sleep a lot. I work super hard too, because I know the company is waiting on us. They wait for this, and then they can't proceed until we get this done.
And how do you persist when it's been 3 months and you still haven't figured it out and the whole company's waiting for you to do it? What's going through your mind during that period?
Pure desperation. No, I guess you have you have a lot of help too, right? I mean, there's like many people that work with you. There's the experts in the different departments, and you can hire people too. I hired people that are smart. I work within my department, people that are smart. And I think over time, we tracked certain things, and then we just figured out one by one whether this is the thing or not. It's pretty systematic. Yeah.
So
I don't know. I guess I don't give up easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You need certain persistence.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And why did you leave SpaceX in 2021?
I don't know. I think I wanted to retire for a long time at the end of the day. I did have a successor at the time. So I actually worked on that. And for 1.5 years, he wrote that SpaceX already, it was working out fine. I kind of like was working with the FAA, didn't really like it either. Disagreed with a lot of people at SpaceX over how to do things. And so I just basically thought this is a good time to leave rather now than later. Mm. And honestly, I haven't regretted it. It worked great. So I discovered that there's a whole world outside. I'm doing lots of different work now. So, it's different pace too, right? I basically work half time. I think probably if you add it all up, compared to maybe 1.5 time. So,
Yeah. And what is your proudest achievement at SpaceX?
People ask me what moment do I remember the most or something like that. I think I still remember the moment you went first orbital very much. I do remember Dragon, docking at the station pretty much. That was pretty epic. And then I do remember the first landing on land with Falcon 9 was pretty epic. The thing with rockets is basically it's either great or it's terrible. It's like very extreme, right? It's like awesome when it works, and it's terrible when it doesn't work. And there's very little in between. This is not, this is like not a normal job. It's way more extreme.
Mm. And it's very bipolar.
It's not something that you pick in a way, but to some extent, I guess I liked it. And I enjoyed the adrenaline, the excitement of a launch. At the end of the day, it's not that exciting anymore when you do this 100. And I did 135. Or rather, either I or somebody from my team. And if somebody from my team worked on that, then, I feel like I was still there. I was still involved. I was still doing this, yeah? So when I left, we had 135 launches. Now that's pretty much what they do in a year or even less. So launch has become routine, I guess. But still, there's still this thing that you're either excited and do it, or when it goes wrong, it's like very depressing.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And how do you think the space industry will change in the next decade?
Good question. So I was certainly hoping that there would be more reusable vehicles. I'm not totally convinced there will, but I see some efforts going into reusable vehicles. Like I have to mention Stoke Space, which I also work on in Seattle. And they worked on the second stage. And second stage is really hard to get reusable. That's a very difficult architectural problem. And second stage, difficult problem to get reusable. That I think people will work on. There will be other constellations, Kuiper from Blue. I think more rockets will be online, New Glenn, I think, is coming online. Ariane 6 from the Europeans is flying, right? It's interesting because none of these are reusable. So my prediction was that a reusable rocket is pretty much dead. Actually, that's not totally true. New Glenn is reusable on the first stage so far, and planning on the upper stage. Yeah, but Ariane 6 is not reusable. And then there's a couple other rockets that come online that have to show that they're reusable. Yeah, and by the time they are reusable, SpaceX will have Starship, and Starship is completely reusable. Mm. Yeah, and so I think SpaceX will stay one step ahead of everybody. The only other company that I know that's trying to do the same thing is Stoke. And they're working towards that on a smaller rocket. So lots of rockets, lots of, offers to launch your payloads. Human spaceflight will be more available because of, vast space station. There's other space stations too. There's still more human space transportation has to be built. That's still missing. But there's still a lot of work to be done to be to have more competition. But yeah. Overall, it's pretty, I mean, compared to what it was 20 years ago, it's way more stuff going on. It's pretty exciting, actually.
Mm. And what's your prediction for when the first human will set foot on Mars?
Oh, yeah, right. I can nothing but do the wrong prediction here, right? Yeah, you can't ruin that. So I said early on by 2030. I don't know. Maybe we need another 2 years or 4 years.
Yeah.
And that, maybe it's safer to do that. Because it does require, a Starship has, even when Starship flies, it has to show that it can be reloaded in orbit. That's difficult. And you don't need a certain number of Starships to reload it. You need, I don't know, between 10 and 16 is the numbers I heard. Yeah. Maybe yeah. as low as 8. Yeah. Depends on really how this works out. Probably need more in the beginning phase and then less when Starship get better. Yeah. So, but let's assume you need a dozen. Yeah. So you need to launch a dozen times and refill. That all takes time, right? And things can go wrong in that time and so on and so forth. So, it's not easy even when it flies, but, I still think Mars is the ultimate goal for SpaceX. I still think they will get there. Maybe not as quick and as quickly as with the high numbers that they want, but it will happen in 30 and 32 or 30, 34. I think actually the timing when you can do this, you can fly every 2 years to Mars, but it's not quite 2 years, I think, right? It's do you know the number, what it is? Is it?
No. It's slightly over, isn't it?
It's like 26 months or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, either way. So it slides and basically what happens is it goes from even numbers to odd numbers by, I think, pretty much next year. So it's not 26, but it's 27, or it's like right at the limit there. And then it's 27, 29, 31, 33, basically, yeah? And so the safer thing to say would be 33, but then I extended my original prediction. But I guess it's new information that I got.
Yeah, yeah. And that, obviously, we're saying every like 26 months. How much further away or how much longer does it take to get back to Earth if you don't go during that 26-month window where Earth and Mars are closer together?
It becomes prohibitive, I think. It becomes really difficult to get there. I actually don't know the numbers, yeah. But it was just like such a steep penalty when you go outside so there's something that's called like a Hohmann transfer, which is like a two impulse transition. And in order to do that, Mars and Earth have to basically be opposite.
Yeah.
If you look down on the universe and our planet system, right, then the Earth has to be on the left side and Mars have to be on the right side at the right timing. Yeah. Mm. So, and then obviously you have to launch earlier so that Mars actually is there when the rocket gets there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if it's not there, then it's really hard to actually get there because your velocity vector is off. And so it becomes really, really prohibitive with that. But to be fair, I haven't done the numbers. Maybe that is something that you can do when you have better propulsion than what we have right now. Right now, chemical propulsion is, how would I say this? It's not, it is obviously efficient, but it's not efficient enough. It needs to be better in order to move around. The distances in the solar systems are just huge.
Yeah.
And then if you consider even going outside the solar systems, the distances become crazy long.
Yeah. Yeah. What would be the alternative to chemical propulsion? Would it be nuclear?
Nuclear. Yeah. Nuclear. Yeah. You heat something up with fission or nuclear energy, and that would be more efficient in the long run. But there's also all the risk on fission and all the risk on nuclear technology. But I think that's where we should slowly move towards.
Mm. Is that being developed or trying to be created?
there was something developed in the 70s, I believe. Like NASA had an engine concept and started working out, but at the end of the day, nobody tried that.
Mm.
So there's still like a lot to do on that.
Yeah.
And who knows, maybe there's alternatives too. Maybe there's ways to, electric propulsion actually is better than chemical, but electric propulsion is just not the thrust of it is just too low.
Mm.
So you have a really, and that's kind of like a conundrum because you have high thrust chemical with relatively, I would say, modest efficiency then. And then you have like high efficient electrical propulsion, but it's a small thrust. It's very hard to actually move. It takes long to move things. So you're efficient and slow, or you're inefficient and fast.
Mm.
You know, it's kind of like,
yeah.
I wish there would be something in the middle.
Mm. Yeah. Would nuclear be in the middle if we figured out how to do it safely?
Nuclear would be more like towards chemical in a way that's high thrust and high efficiency. It's kind of like encompasses both. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And where do you think humans will go after Mars? Say we terraform it and colonize it. Where would the next project be?
The choices are limited in our solar system, right?
Yeah.
You have like maybe Saturn moons that might be attractive, and attractive is a stretch here. might be like worth exploring.
Yeah, yeah.
But not necessarily to do something. And even terraforming Mars, I mean, is kind of like a stretch too, right?
Mm.
It's like Mars is cold and generally needs a lot more global warming, although we seem to be really good at making that.
Yeah.
Venus is too hot, so you can't go further in. I think the Saturn moons would be the next in our system. And then, I mean, eventually you do want to look at other systems and look at other suns and other planets. There's a lot of effort right now on finding planets around distant suns. It turns out there are planets. We can see them, or we can see their shadow, basically. And then some of those have actually, there's a certain area around the sun where you can say, okay, the temperature can be, you know, similar to what it is on Earth. And that's a temperature that, you need for life, fundamentally. So they're finding many, many planets that fulfill those requirements. So there must be more planets around, but then they're very hard to get to unless you have, not even nuclear propulsion, not even efficient propulsion. It's just like, when things are light years away and you can only move with like the speed of light, you're by definition years away, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's like physical barriers that we haven't really grasped completely.
Mm. Yeah. Is it more likely we'll just have these big space probes or space stations revolving around other planets?
Yeah, I mean, a space station could be like a spaceship, basically, right?
Yeah.
For that matter. And a trip to like other solar systems, I don't know what's Proxima Centauri is like a couple light years away. Maybe a couple years on travel time is the right thing to do. But I mean, we are basically in the stone ages of space travel. If you put that in context with that, basically, right? You realize, oh man, we got so much work to do.
Yeah, we do. And to end with some more philosophical and broader questions, the first one is, do you believe in God?
I don't think so, frankly. I mean, maybe there's some overarching divine, you know, thing, but in a practical life, no, not really.
Hmm. And what is the meaning of your life?
So the thing is basically, it's more like there's something here that we don't quite understand. Yeah. And we put God in place of that. Yeah. And I don't think that's an easy, that's certainly something that I don't understand. And I'm kind of amazed by how this whole thing works. Yeah. But do I believe in a traditional, you know, this is somebody who created it? No, I don't. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. Next question.
Yeah. Well, so are you saying there could be some higher thing that we're just completely unaware of?
Yeah. We could be all in a simulation, right?
Yeah. True. Yeah. And the next one was, what is the meaning of your life?
Well, the meaning of life basically is to create more life. That's just fundamentally how I see that. It's kind of like, you live on in your children. And I think that's what I do too. there's obviously some meaning to make things better overall and to create things that make us understand this universe better. That's kind of like a meaningful thing too. There's different ways to be meaningful, not just creating life at the end of the day.
But that's the most fundamental meaning of life, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's what's the same between ants and rabbits and men, I guess.
Yeah. True. And do you think aliens exist?
I'm fairly sure there is life. But because it is so far away, it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Whether there's life or not, unless that life figured out how to... The gaps or the distance between those planets is just so prohibitive physically, not just because we are too stupid to build fast spaceship. Yeah. It's like physics is a real problem here. It doesn't matter to us basically if there's life on other planets or not, but I do believe, that there are other life forms.
It
would be a little bit preposterous to think we are the only one. The universe is so big and there's so many planets, and then we think, oh, this is the only planet that has, I guess, sort of intelligent life. That seems hard to believe to me.
Yeah. So do you think there's very intelligent life out there that's super far away? Or do you think it's more less
Correct.
Complex?
Yeah, exactly. So even if they would send messages like, hey, whatever, this is how you build a spaceship, and they invented that, and they're 20,000 light years away, and they invent this now, and we get it in 20,000. So this is what the thing is, just like physically very, very difficult.
Yeah. Do you think there could be aliens on their way, even if it's in thousands of years' time, to Earth?
I don't know. I don't think so. It's just so many. So then the other side is obviously so many worlds, right? Or so many Earth-like planets, and why would they pick this one?
True. Yeah.
Mind?
Yeah.
So our planet is nothing special in that way. Our sun is nothing special, but then it's obviously very special to us.
Yes. Yeah. True. And if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I think I would stop a little bit more often and think what I'm doing. Like, is this the direction I want to go? I think I kind of like drifted in the right direction, but I think in hindsight, I would have probably done this more conscious. And I lost time by not by making this like a decision that I drift towards rather than actively take. I think taking a time out every year and think where you are and then make correction is, I think, a good thing to do. Right. And often you just live your life and don't realize that you actually make decisions.
Yeah. And if your 20-year-old self can see you now, would he be proud of you?
So pride is a really dangerous feeling, I think. I allow this very briefly. Not very much. So I would certainly hope that to some extent it would be happy to see that, but then also conscious enough to say, hey, you could have done that better. So pride, in my opinion, is often not a great, it's often unjustified. It's just based on where you're born and stuff like that. I mean, that's just random. There's nothing here to be proud about, right? Or sometimes you get in positions where you have some ability to make decisions And then you're proud of that later, but you just got there more or less randomly. Yeah. So I feel like it's a very dangerous feeling. And I try to avoid that, actually.
Mm. Yeah. What do you think 20-year-old you would think about you now, though? If he wasn't proud of you, what do you think he'd think?
Good question. I don't know, frankly. So the thing is basically your head sticks with you, right? Your
head,
your conscious does not grow with you. It doesn't age. So you still have the same conscious to some extent that you have when you were 12.
Yeah.
Or even 5, maybe.
Yeah.
So you fundamentally haven't changed a lot other than, you got better on certain things. You probably got worse in other things. but so you're the same, basically. Yeah, but 20-year-old me would not see that.
Mm.
Yeah. 60-year-old me sees, I'm basically the same, just aged on the outside. But fundamentally, and then I aged on the inside too, I guess. But it's not that traumatic. It's just a slow process that you don't really capture that very, very well. They have probably very different perspectives.
Yeah, no, it's true, actually. I didn't think of it like that because I guess it does. It is such a gradual change over time. So like you suddenly go from 20 to 60, right? So it's...
I have to remind me sometimes how old I am.
Really?
Because otherwise I forget that and do things like I was when I was 20.
Yeah.
Or the other thing I see, like when I go back to pictures or so. Now, it happened that you wouldn't take as many photos like in the last century than in this century with phones and everything. And so I don't really have a lot of photos from that area. But when I do go back and look at the photos, I realize, I did actually this and I did. So I did a lot more things than I remember, basically. Mm. And so I feel like just because it's like so poorly documented, I tend to overlook that. Your memory doesn't reach that far back, or mine at least doesn't. And I only realize on how much time has gone by when I look at some of these old photos.
Yeah. Hans Koenigsmann, ladies and gentlemen. Hans, you were great. I love this. This was a great conversation. I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for joining me.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I really enjoyed it too. And looking forward to seeing it online.
Awesome. If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show, but you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.